Welcome to Family Talk with your host, psychologist and author, Dr. James Dobson, along with Ryan Dobson and Lou Ann Crane.
Well, we are so glad you've joined us for this Family Talk broadcast today because we have a very special treat in store for you. Dr. Dobson and Ryan, there's a special excitement here in our studio today.
Oh, yeah. I actually brought in an LP.
What's an LP, Ryan?
A vinyl record to have signed by our guest today. So this is going to be a neat show.
How did you happen to have a record of the singing of our guest?
I collect records, and it was one of the ones I got in a collection. So, and it's a good one. It's good quality, and it's in perfect condition, and now it's signed, and I love it.
It is an honor to have Pat Boone with us in the studio today. I would really be surprised if anyone over, we'll say 25, does not know and revere you, Pat. You got
well, the
a lot
revere,
of
I don't know about. No,
fans.
Maybe. Yeah, not everybody reveres, unfortunately, what the kind of stuff that you and I have championed. But, you know, I've been called goody two shoes and too good to be true and stick in the mud and all kinds of stuff along the way. And square, that was a word I used to run from. Now I like to stand four square.
Well,
what I believe.
That's what I appreciate about you because you've stayed true to the things you believed all the way through and believe it today.
Yeah.
And I haven't wavered. When I was in college, I have a lot of memories of you. Love letters in the sand.
Yeah. I started out singing what we call rock and roll. My first record was a song called Two Hearts, Two Kisses. It was a rhythm and blues hit by a group called The Charms on
what
the
year?
Dutone label, 1955. It was March of 1955. One heart's not enough, baby. Two hearts will make you feel crazy. One kiss will make you feel so nice. Two kisses take you to paradise. Two hearts, two kisses make one love.
All right, see, that was 55.
55.
Love Letters in the Sand
was 57. And between Two Hearts, Two Kisses, which was a million seller, my very first record, then came Ain't That a Shame and a bunch more. And Tutti Frutti and Long Tall Sally and I'll Be Home and
all those records. You're re-recording Little Richard?
Yeah. Two of them. Million sellers. And, of course, there's a misconception about that on the part of people who didn't live through the time because rhythm and blues was a separate genre of music. They had their own radio stations. They had their own charts and the magazines. Their own artists, and it was, as the Bible might say, a great gulf fixed between rhythm and blues and pop music.
But Elvis transcended.
But I beat him to it. I was the first, actually. I call myself the midwife at the birth of rock and roll. Now that may not be a good thing, but it was a fact that from March of 55. Now this doesn't sound possible, but I didn't even realize it till years later when we did actual statistical research. But from March of 55 to February of 56, which is when Elvis made his first record of Heartbreak Hotel, I had 6 million sellers and two of them were number ones in 11 months. It doesn't sound possible because people don't put records out that fast anymore. Mm. But it's our MO, method of operation at the record company. Then, as soon as one of my records peaked and dropped from number two to number four, we came out with the next record. So it capitalized on the momentum and kept the momentum
How
up.
How did you get started, Pat? I mean, what was your introduction to Hollywood?
Well, goodness, it was a circuitous thing, and it didn't seem possible to me. I remember so clearly as a 17, 18-year-old boy still milking our family cow out on Lone Oak Road in Nashville. Her name was Rosemary. And I'm sitting there milking. And it doesn't take brain power to do that, so I'm fantasizing. And I don't remember explicitly praying to the Lord, but, you know, I would he knew my thoughts and my heart. And I was just thinking that if I were in the place of Julius LaRosa on the Arthur Godfrey Show.
Oh, yeah.
I would sing a song in the morning. I would have all day. I could go to an Ivy League college, maybe. I could help with charities like Danny Thomas, Danny Kaye, Bing Crosby, Bob Hope did, contribute to medical research and education. And that was all a dream. Well, within about 2 years after my last squirt in the bucket sitting under Rosemary, I had replaced Julius LaRosa on The Godfrey Show. Mm-hmm. I took a route through North Texas State in Denton. Briefly, after Shirley and I married, I went out there. I was going to be a schoolteacher preacher.
And I wonder if anybody listening to us in the younger generation knows who Arthur Godfrey was.
Probably.
Do you know, Luann?
I know the name, but you'll have to explain.
Ryan, do you know?
I know the name. That's the hard part.
How are you,
ladies? Brought to you by Lipton Tea and Lipton Noodle Soup. He owned radio and television at CBS for years and was on more. He was on an hour and a half radio a day, live.
Did you sing every day?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And while I was in school at Columbia University, I won the Ted Mack Amateur Hour in a fluky thing. That was the original American Idol type thing where the viewers of this big network TV show selected the winners from week to week. And I won 3 weeks in a row. Kid from Nashville singing pop songs led to a recording contract. I left North Texas State, transferred to Columbia University, so I was in an Ivy League school. Replaced Julius LaRosa on The Godfrey Show. And because I was married and Shirley and I were having a baby every year, but I did take time always from then right till now to take part in all kind of charitable activities because that's what I told the Lord I would do if I ever had that platform.
Well,
that
you had a squeaky clean image.
Yeah.
And it was a good thing. It was not a derogatory thing,
no,
but you did take some heat
for
it.
It wasn't the most commercial thing because, as Elvis proved, I'm in college. I'm married. I'm having a baby a year. I'm in church every Sunday morning and Sunday night and Wednesday night, leading the congregational singing. And everybody knows this. The teenagers, they didn't care because I was still so young that I was literally like one of them. I'm in college. I'm wearing white buck shoes.
I wanted to ask you about that because I had a pair and so did everybody I knew.
Right.
You really did influence that generation right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and it was – then all of a sudden, here comes Elvis. And I have often said that he was like pepper and I was salt. And, you know, most people like a little salt and a little pepper. He was the rebel. He was breaking the rules and was a great concern to the parents, the teachers, the preachers because of his on-stage gyrations. And then he'd make some comments along the way. He was asked – and I was the guy playing by all the rules and winning, and he was the guy breaking the rules and winning. And there was something about each of us that appealed to a lot of the same teenage girls and boys. And so an interviewer asked Elvis once, when are you going to get married and settle down and have kids like Pat Boone? And there's a video of him looking toward the camera with that little, you know, kind of little leer, that little kind of a sneery smile he had. He said, why should I buy a cow when I can get milk through the fence? And a boom, the alarm went off, you know, and parents and preachers. And yet it sent some kind of a thrill through a lot of impressionable young girls.
Parents actually protested his dancing, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, because
and in fact, I'm told that Ed Sullivan would not allow him to be photographed or with television cameras.
Below the hips.
Yeah.
That's right. The first time he was on television, they didn't show what was going on beneath.
How the world has changed.
And you know what? He was wearing white buck shoes. They were all scuffed up, but nobody was going to notice his feet because of what was happening above that.
Did you start the white buck thing?
No. I was the first guy, though. It was unintentional, not premeditated, but I was wearing what all the high school, college kids, maybe you too, were wearing already, and they were the only decent pair of shoes I had. As I say, I had just transferred up from North Texas State. I was doing local TV there. I was preaching in a little country church out in Slidell, Texas, student preacher. I was going to be a teacher preacher. But I wore the white bucks, which were they go with anything, and they were the only decent pair of shoes I had. So the first few appearances I made on TV, kids saw somebody that looked like them.
Do you guys know what he's talking about?
I sure
you
do.
Know
of
what
course.
White shoes?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. The ones I had had red soles.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And we'd work hours before we'd have a date. We had a little thing called bunny bag where you would hit the white bucks and they would turn real white.
They
and
were almost like these that I'm wearing.
Yeah, very much.
Except these happen to have canvas. I mean, they have sponge soles just because they're fun to wear. But I wear white bucks.
We would take a little toothbrush in order to clean those red soles.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't stay
and the little dust bag
for more than about 40 minutes.
That's
and
right.
They were a mess again.
You couldn't keep from bumping them. You're active kids and you're running and you're bumping into things and people step on your feet. So they eventually started selling pre-dirtied bucks that were already scuffed up and even sort of a tan color.
And then Elvis sang about not stepping on your blue suede shoes. So he changed it a little bit.
He changed a lot of things.
Yeah.
And yet we knew, he and I, we were two teenage, well, barely out of our teens, boys from Tennessee. And he was from Memphis and I'm from Nashville. And we were both from lower income, lower middle income families, church-going families. He and his mom and dad sang in church. And certainly my mom and dad, my brother, two sisters, we all did.
Did you meet him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got to be pretty good friends. The first time we met, he was my opening act in Cleveland at a sock hop. And this was a phenomenon that was going on then where big DJs would put on these record hops and the kids would all dance to the records and the DJ would play them and he would, wherever possible, have one of the artists come in and headline, in this case, Cleveland. It was October, I think, 22nd of 1955. I had three hit records already since March of that year. And I came in at the request of Bill Randall. He was the nation's number one DJ and he had 3,000 kids in a high school in Cleveland. And he picked me up at the airport that day when I came in from New York. He says, I got a kid coming in from Shreveport, Louisiana.
I was born here.
Shreveport. He was appearing on the Louisiana Hayride radio show. And he says he's made a record for RCA. We haven't heard it yet. And I said, what's his name? He said, Elvis Presley. I said, I've heard that record on a jukebox out in Texas. I said, Bill, he's a hillbilly. You think he's going to go over? Because it was a hillbilly, a Flat and Scruggs song called Blue Moon of Kentucky. And he said, well, RCA Victor thinks he's got something, so we'll hear. So that night at the sock hop, 3,000 kids ready to scream and dance and waiting for me, actually. But then they introduced this young kid, Elvis, and he came out and he had his collar turned up. His hair was real greasy and long. His pants were long. As I say, he had white bucks. And he sang, Blue Moon of Kentucky, keep on shining. Well, that didn't really go over that well in Cleveland. But then he finished that, lip-syncing it, and then he says, thank you very much. I like to do another song on the other side of that record. Hope you like it. And he sang, That's All Right, Mama. That's All Right with Me. And that was a rhythm and blues song. And he was twitchy. He wasn't really gyrating a lot, but he was a little twitchy and hyper, and this got the girls pretty good. And I had to follow him. Well, thank God I had three hit records, so I got all the screams that night. When I came off, he was gone. Later, we got to be friends, and we were visiting each other in Bel Air, California, both leasing homes. And I said, Elvis, that first time we met, you seemed so shy, so nervous. He said, well, I know how to talk to you, man. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you were a star. I said, a star? I hadn't been recording since March. And he said, yeah, but you were on the charts. I didn't know how to talk to you. And that just shows how really sort of naive and modest he was
in those early days.
But he got over the modesty part.
Did you ever perform on the Dick Clark show?
Oh, yeah. In fact.
I mean, tell people who he was, those who don't remember.
I know him.
Do you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, Dick Clark. In fact, people used to confuse us a lot. They would think he was me and I was Dick Clark. And we kidded each other about that. We'd say, I'd say to him, aren't you Pat Boone? He said, yeah, aren't you Dick Clark? Because we both had sort of a clean cut look, you know. But he introduced on his TV show, The American Bandstand, in the afternoons, five afternoons a week. And he had all the big stars coming on lip syncing their records and the kids dancing. And I met him first when he was the off-camera studio announcer in Philadelphia for American Bandstand then, which was hosted by a guy named Bob Horn. Bob, and it was a big teenage hit, and Dick Clark was just the off-camera studio announcer. You hear his voice but not see him. I visited with him back then, and he appreciated the fact that I went back to talk to him. He was doing some radio and very young. And later, Bob Horn got in trouble with one of the teenage girls on his show and was removed immediately, and Dick Clark took over. And then ABC brought him to New York, and they launched the national American Bandstand.
It was a phenomenon.
And Jerry Lee Lewis and I were his first guests.
Really?
Yeah.
What was Hollywood like in those days compared to now?
It was so different now. There was a star culture, and somehow the stars, you know, they seem larger than life, and the producers and everybody wanted them to be that, and they had to, though they were not always living moral lives, the immorality was kept out of the news. And for instance, Ingrid Bergman, you know, she had an affair with the big producer Rossellini, I think his name was, and had a child out of wedlock.
She had to leave the country.
Yeah. And it looked like her movie career was over. Robert Mitchum was arrested for marijuana possession, went to prison. And people thought, well, that's the end of his career. But when he came back out, he was bigger than ever. But it used to be that if a star was homosexual or if he was promiscuous, having affairs, that they kept PR people working full time to keep all that out of the news. And the stuff on the screen did not promote or aggrandize that, glamorize it either. I mean, for a long time, a man and woman, Clark Gable and a starlet or an actress, couldn't be in the same bed even if they were married.
Yeah. How much pressure was put on you as the years went by to change your image and to kind of get with what was going on?
There was some pressure. In fact, I turned down a movie with Marilyn Monroe. She was under contract to 20th. I was too. We both had these long-term multi-picture deals. So they said, hey, let's put Pat Boone and Marilyn Monroe together in a film. Well, you know, what young actor wouldn't like to be in a movie with Marilyn Monroe? Of course I would have. But I read the script, and it was an immoral script about a young guy in a small town having an affair with a still beautiful but slightly over-the-hill cabaret singer. No, it was like Bus Stop by the same author, William Inge. She comes back to her hometown to regroup and decide what she's going to do with her life, meets this young kid. He flips over her, and they wind up having an affair. She's flattered by it. She's lonely.
And you turned it down.
I turned it down. I said to the head of the studio and risked suspension to Buddy Adler. I said, Mr. Adler, I've got a lot of teenage fans, and I can't make this film. It's about a guy having an affair with an older woman. He says, yeah, but it's going to be a big hit. It's Marilyn Monroe. After all, she leaves town, and he goes back on with his life. That today they call those coming-of-age films. But he says, you know, we could suspend you, and if we suspend you, so will the music
industry
and the TV, and you'll be virtually finished. I said, I understand. You have to make the decisions you have to make because this is your business.
Were you committed to Christ at that time?
Oh, yeah.
Were you raised in a Christian home?
Oh, yeah. I was a Christian from when I was 13, and I knew.
And you were trying to live by that standard.
Yeah. And therefore, I had to turn down films. I had to turn down songs. And, you know, these were not expedient things for me to do, of course. They did go ahead and make the film. It was called The Stripper, I think. And that's really what the female actress had been, not just a cabaret singer. And Joanne Woodward played the part. Richard Beamer, who had done West Side Story, did the part they wanted me to do. It was a colossal bomb. Now, it might have been a hit if it was Marilyn Monroe and me, but so much the worse because it would have tended to glamorize or excuse and profit from something that was totally immoral. I just couldn't do it.
Pat, you sold 45 million records. You had 38 top 40 hits. What part did God play in that and in your life?
Everything. You know, people, I tell them that my career is totally just God's doing because, you know, I'm not somebody with an amazing voice. I can carry a tune, and I like to sing, and I evidently people like to hear it, but, you know, there's nothing exceptional about it. But I kept having hit after hit after hit.
There and, was something exceptional about it.
At least recognizable. And so people
I've
say,
actually
you
got
God,
two hearts, two kisses.
Have you got two hearts, yeah. two kisses? Wow, that's the first million
I'm
seller.
I'm surprising my dad.
And I had 13 million sellers, gold records, and they just kept coming. And people say, ask me, you think God gave you, ain't that a shame to sing? And I said, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Because the Bible says, and I was aware of it then, God chooses, this is in 1 Corinthians, as you know, the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. He does things we don't think he would do. He told Moses, you're going to take my people out of Egypt. And Moses says, I can't do that. God said, what's that in your hand? It was a stick. It was just a stick, a staff. He says, that'll be all you need. Mm. Same with parting the Red Sea. He chooses foolish things so that wealthy and wise in their own minds people don't come to God because of any of that. They come in simple faith like the most ordinary common person in the world. And Paul said, you see, not many wealthy or famous people, you know, in the body of Christ. It's more just ordinary folks who are willing to come to him on his terms and not ours. So, yeah, ain't that a shame? Tutti Frutti, Long Tall Sally, even the heavy metal songs that I did, it got me back on the charts after 30 years, that album.
That'd been a big splash. I remember when that came out, that was a big splash.
And there was nothing wrong with any of the songs. Mm-mm. In fact, if you listen very carefully, and this is a scoop, I did Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. And a lot of folks just assumed that was about drugs because it has some mysterious images about a woman looking for something that she can't find and she must have it or this or that. Well, I didn't see any specific allusion to drugs. But at the very last, there's a little line at the last about when all is one and one is all. And it sounded like that kind of theology that says in the end, you know, it'll all work out and everybody will be okay. So I changed it to when the three in one is all in all. Mm-hmm. If you listen carefully, then I turned Stairway to Heaven into a Christian song, which Stairway to Heaven ought to be.
Could a committed Christian like you, who's trying to live for Christ, make it in Hollywood today? Mm-hmm.
It's very tough because the producers, the writers, they all seem hell-bent on doing films and breaking all the taboos. Mm. They think that this will create the biggest success. Mm-hmm. And the actors and actresses have sort of come to the point where they'll do most anything to get into a film and to try to be successful. Take off their clothes, simulate sex, drugs.
Doesn't that break your heart?
It is,
especially
because we
when they're influencing
that.
The kids. As
their
I
kids,
wore
yeah.
white bucks because you wore white bucks,
yeah.
they're jumping into bed because what they're seeing on television.
It seems so exciting and fun, and people get away with it, and seems glamorous. So, of course, they emulate. People talk about art imitating life, but life often imitates art. Mm. And when I'm on the Parents Television Council with Steve Allen.
Hey, I'm going to stop you right
because
we're out of time.
Uh-oh.
And I'd like to just go on talking from right here, and we'll let people hear it next time. But I want to start with that.
Okay.
The Parents Television Council, which is trying to have
clean
an influence.
Clean up TV. Yeah.
And you're doing a great work there. And I'd like to talk about that and some of the other things that
if
you're
you
doing.
If you insist.
Can you be with us?
Yes, I will.
All
sure.
right. God bless you, Pat.
Thank you, Jim.
Appreciate your consistent stance for righteousness. You've been out there fighting on the front lines. And you and I have been friends
course,
for a long, long time. Well, we all do.
Or
we wouldn't need a Savior.
That's right. You know? That's right.
But anyway, I bring you greetings from my Shirley to you
both
and your Shirleys.
Aren't we lucky?
Yeah, we are at that. And we'll talk again.
Okay.
And we'll sure look forward to it. Ryan, I have no doubt that listeners have enjoyed this conversation as much as we have, and it's great we get to spend one more day with Mr. Boone tomorrow.
This was one of my favorite broadcasts. Where else do you
How
get
often
to hear...
can you say that, Ryan?
I know, but it was so great. Where else do you hear conversations like this? To hear Pat Boone's history and his personality, his passion, absolutely amazing. I know listeners are thinking, I have a friend who would love this broadcast. We'd love to send it to you on CD. You can call us at 877-732-6825, 877-732-6825.
And at myfamilytalk.com, we also have links to lots more information on all of Pat's latest, both professional and philanthropic ventures. He has lots of new stuff going on there. Check that out, myfamilytalk.com.
And, Luann, there is still time to get a copy of our 2010 Family Talk broadcast collection. It features 18 full days of programming, some of the best shows that we've had in the last calendar year. You can find that also at myfamilytalk.com or call us. One last time, our number is 877-732-6825.
Thanks for listening, and make sure to be with us next time when we'll continue our conversation with music legend Pat Boone.